Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
And welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here every day this time, Monday through Friday, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And we are we're joined today on this fine Tuesday afternoon by my co-host, America's tallest radio Catholic co-host, Tom McDonald. Tom McDonald is... a scribe. He scribbles for the National Catholic Register. He scribbles here. He scribbles there. He scribbles, scribbles everywhere. Yep. Is he in heaven? That's right. Is he in hell? The damned elusive Pimpernel. I don't Catholic know where that came from. The Catholic Pimpernel. So
there actually was. There's a book called the Vatican. There's a book called The Vatican Pimpernel, I think, about a man who worked during the war to save Jews. If that's what I'm remembering, the subject is
Monsignor.
About.
He was Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty, I believe was his name.
Oh, O'Flaherty, that's correct. You're right. It was.
There's a movie called The Scarlet and the Black about him, where he's played by Gregory Peck. And
really.
Yeah, at one point, he was an Irishman from the Republic of Ireland, mind you.
Yeah,
not
we won't hold
North.
That against her.
And at some point, some American POWs wind up in the Vatican, and so he finds a place for them to live. And they talk to him briefly, and one of them says, "You're not, are you English?" Which he didn't take well.
I would think not. You know,
go ahead.
I did some stuff on Pope Saint, we can call him now, John the 23rd, and he was a church historian, actually, just like me.
Yeah.
But much better at it. He was a librarian and all. And he was actually very involved in a lot of that, behind the scenes skullduggery to help people to give, fake passports to Jews and things like that.
Right.
You know, so a lot of that stuff, you know, you get these lies that come out about, Hitler's Pope and stuff, which was so far from the truth that I'm not quite sure how you could get further from the truth, you know, than to say that about Pius. But and especially with John the 23rd having been involved with so much of that, who was involved so much with Jewish relations, you know, and Nostra Aetate has his handprints all over it. So that particular period, I don't know as much about it because it's, you know, not the period I've been studying lately, but it's a fascinating thing that the story hasn't wholly been told. I mean, you know, you've got Hugh O'Flaherty and you've got some of these things, but there's much more that we don't know about yet that went on in World War II, you know, in which we were not Hitler's Pope.
You know? Right.
And right. The current scandal,
and Hitler
the history
was
scandal.
Hitler's plan was to kidnap. Hitler wanted to kidnap Pius and kill him.
He was no friend of the Nazis, you know. And the thing was, when there was edicts read out in Holland, I believe it was, if I'm remembering correctly, there were repercussions. You know, when the Catholic Church started to push back, people were rounded up and sent to camps. You know, and a lot of them never returned. You know, so there was a very fine line they had to walk during World War II.
Yeah,
you know, but nobody there's no Catholic scandal that somebody is not willing to like flog into you know, beat into flames if they can find it. Now we're getting the church history scandal this week is about John Paul allegedly wrote romantic letters to a married woman, and the people who actually this is the BBC did this story on these letters to this American Polish philosopher American she was Polish descent, and the Polish library that holds the letters says it says nothing of the sort. The letters were known and viewed as part of the canonization process. This is nothing. But the BBC article is, you know, Pope writes romantic letters to married woman. I'm thinking, you people suck so much.
Stop. How do you even wake?
Why do you? How do you even wake up and look at yourselves every day? It's like, let's see what we can do evil today. It's like Snidely Whiplash is controlling the entire Fifth Estate. But okay, well, rant, you know, over.
I think there's a couple of things that often come up here. One is the idea that priests somehow or other undergo some kind of mind control exercise, right, or perhaps kind of chemical castration, or something happens so that priests stop being men, right? And it's like there's that dynamic going on, and then you discover the priests are men because, I mean, to me, it's quite irrelevant whatever John Paul's feelings might have been. The fact is, of course, is that he remains a faithful celibate all of his life.
And they're never despite all the headlines, they're not he's saying otherwise, but they're still making headlines look untoward. I can tell you, actually, I can offer a tiny bit of insight into why the media in particular tends to think this. It's because journalism schools, which I loathe, and I never went to journalism school, but they all work from a similar template. I don't want to slander the person. It might have been Cokie Roberts. Don't hold me to that. But somebody was asking, you know, about bias in the media. And this person, and it was a female reporter, very famous, said, and she was not kidding. This was actually something she believed. I had my political opinion surgically removed in journalism school. And I thought that was like a punchline. But no, it was said with all seriousness that they literally believe. They actually believe that there's a portion of themselves that they don't. You know, that they no longer think in those terms, and that they can be wholly objective. And I've banged on for, you know, I've been writing, publishing now since I'm like 18, and I'm 47, I think. And I can tell you that there is no such thing as objectivity. It doesn't exist. You know, you can pretend, and if you're pretending, you're usually missing the fact that you're really secretly subjective.
Right.
But, you know, so they're believing that these popes and things, you know, well, they're celibate. They must have had that removed.
Right. And then it's treated like hypocrisy if we discover that, you know, so for example, Father Benedict Rochelle wrote quite movingly about an experience of feeling romantic attraction toward a woman. He didn't do anything about it, of course, because he was a faithful priest. But does that happen? Of course that happens. These are men. And so subject to, you know, everything that men are subject to. And those things happen. And so the idea that somehow a priest could feel that is treated as some kind of a betrayal. It's like, no, it's they're just human beings. And what matters is how they live out their vow in the face of that. But in addition to that, I think there's something else here, which is that I've said for years that part of the problem with our culture is that all relationships, all strong personal relationships, tend to get eroticized in our culture. So we don't have any room for friendship, for example.
Well, true.
And friendship, therefore, all it has to be sublimated eros. So if two men have a very strong friendship, you think, for example, of the kind of friendship that bound the Inklings together. That was a group that was all about friendship.
Sure.
It couldn't have been friendship. It has to have been some kind of sublimated homosexual relationship.
Well, that's a tawdry academic thing that goes on now, and it's like you're saying, it's this eroticization of everything. I think it was Tony Esselin, who is a Catholic writer and the translator of Dante, I think he was the one who wrote a piece called The End of Friendship, basically, or something around that theme, that male friendship and male love, yeah, as it was known, let's say, in the time of Shakespeare, where he could write these incredibly charged poems that were dedicated to men, and in the Renaissance, this wouldn't have been unusual. That's over. Right. That space where that could exist is gone. And it existed because the relationship between men and women themselves tended to be less close emotionally a lot of times, especially at the upper classes, when a lot of marriages may have been arranged, or they may have been, you know, necessarily right, marriages of convenience or something. So that male friendships tended to be very, very emotional, you know, without having any erotic overtones, you know, and you see that up through history. You see it going back to the Greeks, which is probably a bad example since they could have erotic overtones there, but they didn't always. Right. And was that there's an end of that now. It can't happen again because it would be deemed suspicious and gay and everything else.
Right. But exactly the same thing happens, of course, between men and women, too.
Sure.
And we have a culture that not only denies that, but has even, one of the biggest hit movies of the 80s was an entire movie that was premised on the thesis that men and women cannot be friends.
What was that?
You know what I'm talking about? Meg Ryan.
Is that When Harry Met Sally? Yeah,
When Harry Met Sally. Men and women cannot be friends. Any kind of strong, you know, essentially an epistolary relationship, especially after he becomes Pope, you know, but, you know, one of the marks of John Paul's entire priesthood was that he, unlike a lot of priests, conducted profound friendships with a bunch of different lay people. We'll continue that when we continue. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. You're listening to me and Tom McDonald here on Breadbox Media, and we'll be back right after this.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Tom McDonald. We've been talking a bit about the little kerfuffle in the global press because of BBC, basically saying, great land of Goshen. John Paul II had, you know, a friendship with a woman.
Right.
Which is like, he had a friendship with a ton of lay people.
Right.
Married and single. He, you know, this is where his theology of the body material comes from, is from conversations with actual lay people about their married life. This is a guy who routinely, you know, went skiing and kayaking, and he spent, you know, a good chunk of the 50s and the 60s. You know, this is a guy who's like, he was busy in the chancery doing things as a bishop, and busy in the parish as a priest doing things. But unlike so many other priests, this is a guy who was formed by an intense experience of multiple friendships with lay people.
Right. Now, there's no question here that this was a very close friendship. You know, and that, you know, they talk things at an emotionally higher pitch.
Right.
But, you know, there's nothing untoward there. And I don't know if it were somebody saying, as it did with the revelations of Mother Teresa's spiritual aridity, which nobody still understands, because if you understand St. John of the Cross and you understand that level of mysticism from that period, that's actually a part of it, that spiritual dryness that Mother Teresa allegedly complained about, and, yeah. That led her, and then I had one of my students come out, well, I understand she'd stop believing in God. And I'm like,
no, that's
not what it was. Right. So when you look at, some of the letters, they're, she obviously, I think, might have had a crush on him. And he said he doesn't know how to respond to this and sent her a scapular, which is kind of a fairly certain, priests have to deal with this, by the way. They become... Sure. It's just like in The Sopranos, remember, with Father what's his a bad example. But it's interesting because last month there was a book on sale. It was called Meanwhile There Are Letters, and it was on Kindle for like 99 cents. It was the correspondence of Ross McDonald and Eudora Welty. Ross McDonald was married to Margaret Millar, another famous novelist. Ross McDonald, the famous mystery novelist, and Eudora Welty, the famous author. And they had an intense platonic long-distance relationship that was essentially an epistolary love affair, almost, to some degree, that never consummated in any sense. But they both found emotional connections in their letters, and it was wholly carried out through letters. It's something that people don't seem to grasp anymore because we immediately sexualize everything. It's just what the culture does. It's what a barbaric culture does, frankly, is it immediately goes to the lowest common denominator or to the erotic element and sees that in everything. You can't get through, you can't even study English literature or even aspects of history anymore without finding that. I was just calling up it's funny because before we went on, I was calling up the University of Wales Press list of books because they have a series on King Arthur in different regions. And I've been doing some study because I might be writing something on King Arthur in the Lives of the Saints because he shows up in hagiography, believe it or not. And they've got a ton of books on queer vampires is the names of these things, or the gay other in Gothic literature. I mean, everything has to be...
everything is sexual.
Here's one, the queer uncanny. What? Who writes this stuff? And who reads it? Nobody reads it, but, it's this idea that everything has to be looked at through a deviant sexual perspective. Yeah. And, we really don't need to be doing that. Soapbox... stacked off and put away now.
All right, thank you. Yeah, but it is, I think it is fascinating that, it's always the case. I mean, people love, they cherish the notion, and nowhere more so than in England, where it's been a national sport for five centuries, to imagine Rome as nothing but this den of curtain gliding Jesuits, hiding all the seamy horrors of the awful revelations of Maria Monk, and of course, throughout history, when you have a religious tradition that values celibacy, you're always going to have a percentage of priests who violate their vows. That happens. Sure. Wow.
And sometimes you're going to get an Alexander the Seventh.
Sure. Yeah. And you do get, although, it's been a while since we've had an Alexander the Seventh. There really is, or an Alexander.
It has been quite a long time. Well, honestly,
it's really been a long time.
We're talking like 400 years since we've had a really, 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 truly
terrible pope.
Yeah, I mean, we got to go back to the Renaissance, which, by the way, in case you didn't read the books, everything was going wrong.
Yeah, and so the priest scandals and the behavior of bishops has made very clear that there is, and by the way always will be, corrupt action in the church and corruption in the church that goes all the way up the episcopal ladder. Okay, all duly noted. But, at the same time, come on, look at the life of John Paul II. This is a guy who really, really insists on the integrity of the priestly vow.
Sure. This was not just a saint. It was a man who was obviously a saint.
Right. Yeah. And so it's, you know, I really hope, because this is, you know, that's what lies behind all of this.
Oh, of course.
I really hope that they had some seamy affair, which is the subtext of this whole story. It's like that didn't happen.
No, it absolutely. There's no indication or anything on either part of their characters or in any of the evidence. But that's not, you know, that doesn't stop them from kind of twisting it a bit and putting it all out there. And, you know, she only died, I believe, a year or two ago when these letters were finally put in the library. But I believe they were made available to you know, the committee investigating canonization to the cause, you know, so and they said they did look at them. I just don't know where they looked at them, in the library or where. But, you know, I you don't know what to say, because it's just everything now is hypersexualized in television and ads. And you knew that there was no turning back from it once the sexualization of children started with full force in the media and everything else. You know, when you see from Halloween costumes to clothing to, you know, basically borderline kiddie porn that goes on. You knew that the culture was really not recovering from that. You know, we've kind of bottomed out there. Something's definitely... We blew a fuse somewhere along the line.
Yeah. So it's you know, it's one of those things that this is the minor panic du jour this week. But as people, you know, get familiar with the story, they're going to go, oh,
yeah, it's going to go on. Well, that's a bit
nothing here, you know. But
it's scandalous, isn't it? Hey, I gave you a segue.
Thank you. Yes. And speaking of panics du jour and scandal. you know, one of the things that our media culture, you know, thrives on is this, what I call the panic du jour. You know, every day we're fed some story where we're all supposed to have a heart attack, you know, and get all upset and da, 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 da. And this week, you know, this past weekend, we saw the loss of one of the great, I think, figures in American Supreme Court history. He's somebody who's going to stick out for a long time. There are a lot of Supreme Court justices where you go, was that guy a Supreme Court justice? You know, I don't remember, you know, who was on the court,
right?
You know, 50 years ago. I don't know. I mean, Earl Warren, I know, was on the court. Sure. I remember that, but I couldn't tell you who.
Well, that's because he fixed the Kennedy conspiracy.
Oh, well, okay.
It's the only reason we know the Warren Commission and all.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. But, you know, Scalia, I think, is going to go down in history for good and bad reasons.
He was a sharp thinker, a real Renaissance thinker in a time that didn't give, you know, in a time where judicial logic was slipping into mere emotionalism. He retained not just this razor sharp logic of, you know, we're going to it means what it means, you know.
Right. And plus,
but this kind of Renaissance.
Plus, he was funny as hell.
He was. I read some of his decisions, and he would draw on all kinds of literature and things. Now, he obviously had clerks working with him on the first draft. Somebody asked him on his process, but that was all they worked on, allegedly, that he worked on the other drafts and things. And so you get this extremely sharply tuned mind that, you know, doesn't have these soft edges.
Yeah, what strikes me, there was a number of things that struck me. The first was I was very surprised, and very pleased to see that a number of people who deeply disagreed with him politically and ideologically were amazingly gracious at his death.
Yeah.
So Bernie Sanders because I'm so used to somebody dies and then immediately people are like dancing on his grave.
Yeah. Oh, I found some of that too.
There was that, you know.
Oh, yeah, I saw some pretty horrific ones.
There was a lot of that, you know. And the other thing that happens is somebody dies, and as Ted Cruz did, it's like instantly politicized, you know. And it's like, just shut up. Give it 24 hours, will you? Wait until his body is cool. But we'll come back to this in a minute. I want to discuss this a little bit further. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here with Tom McDonald, and we'll be back right after this.
Lightbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Yeah, he was like, they were having this big diocesan conference in Denver, and I was asked to be one of the, you know, 50 million people who was giving a workshop on a thing. So I gave a workshop on a thing, and then you went into the great central hall, and then they had like the real speakers, the keynote guys. So they had like John Allen give a talk, John Allen Jr.
Right, people really show up to see.
Right. And so Scalia was at this thing. And so he gave a talk. And then afterwards, all of us speaker types got taken off to dinner. So I wound up like, you know, in a room a couple of tables away from him.
That's neat.
Wound up chewing the fat with John Allen, of all people, he was standing there next to me in line waiting for the little finger sandwichy things or whatever, you know. And so we just, you know, we just struck up a conversation. I knew who he was. He'd never heard of me, of course. And, well, why should he, you know? And so we, you know, it was funny, actually. It was an interesting conversation because he said I think he said he went to J school, but the point of the conversation was that he very quickly learned as a young writer that your academic credentials don't matter one iota at all. He says the writing is one of the last places in our culture that's a complete meritocracy. It has nothing to do with anything other than the question, can he write?
Right.
If you can write and your editor likes the stuff that you write, you will be published. And no editor will ever ask you, what did you get your degree in?
Nope.
He won't care, right?
Never have. No, I mean, I never studied writing. I have no writing degree. My undergraduate degree is a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Film.
Yeah.
And an English degree on the side. And then my master's was in theology with church history.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can't remember, was it, it was Flannery O'Connor. Somebody said, do you think writing programs, you know, really, you know, suppress writers? And she says, I think they don't suppress enough.
That's good. Yeah. But, so anyway, that was an interesting evening. And so, you know, I breathed some of the same oxygen as Antonin Scalia did at one point. And,
well, if they were conspiring to kill him at the time, then that could have been poisoned oxygen.
It might have been part of the plan. Who knows? Maybe I was the trigger. But at any rate, you know, I watched this weekend, and there were various responses. There were classy responses.
Sure.
From people who said what you're supposed to say when somebody dies. My mom was one of those people that just raised me that, you know, it doesn't matter if it was Hitler. I mean, you'd say something nice, right?
Right.
Somebody dies. There, you know, speaking of Flannery O'Connor, Flannery O'Connor famously said that you can't get poorer than dead. that is the absolute, you know, when you've died, you are exposed in all of your nakedness as the completely dependent, sinful wretch that you always were, who completely needs the grace of God, and you've got nothing else on your side right now other than the grace of God and the prayers of people, you know, who are, God willing, who are interceding for you.
Right.
And so my attitude is, you know, I don't really care what you thought about the deceased.
Right.
Say a prayer for him and then shut your gob for a couple of days. You know,
there's a cartoon that goes around on Twitter, and it's somebody saying it's a guy who looks sort of like the guy on the computer, and he says, "Hey, I'm you from the future. I've come to tell you that nobody cares about your hot takes on the news."
Yeah, And so, you know, I'm listening to these people, you know, and there were people who were gracious, a number of people who were gracious and just said,
just what you, because that makes you look better because you don't, you know.
It just makes you look decent. I mean, this is like bottom line, bare minimum stuff, right?
Right.
It was one of the things that I disliked most intensely about Christopher Hitchens. God rest his soul. Was, you know, he did this constantly. Every time somebody died, he would instantly show up to just trash them. They brought him in for color commentary on Mother Teresa's funeral, and all he did was just spend the whole time just trashing her. And I thought, this is lower than dirt.
It really
doing
is.
This kind of I stuff. And that was Mother Teresa,
you know?
What's that?
I saw him do it to Jerry Falwell once. Somebody would have had anything nice to say. The most I would have said is, God rest your soul, because but see, they don't.
It's what you do, you know?
There's this thing, because most of them, obviously Hitchens, are atheists, so they don't feel any moral compunction. They're not restrained by basic social niceties that have a moral component to them on death. Death is just your worm food. So who cares what you say about him?
Yeah, and it's very much that, you know, what comes through is, and the thing that appalled me was two things. People who just hated Scalia, and the moment that he died, you know, were just erupting in glee, which I just found appalling. But, you know, Jesus makes the distinction. He says, those to whom much is given, much will be required. The servant who does not know his master's will be beaten with few blows when he doesn't do it. But the servant who knows his master's will be beaten with many blows. So the people who, you know, don't know anything about common decency, and who, you know, treated Scalia's death with glee, you know, I look at that and I'm appalled. But on the other hand, what do they know?
Right.
So it was like, okay, that's appalling, but let's just draw a discreet veil over this disgusting display of glee. Right.
And it says nothing at all about the person they're trashing. The words coming out of their mouth to trash whomever the recent dead is says nothing about the dead.
No, it's all about
the speaker.
It says everything about the speaker. It's just you poor soul, you know, that you would respond to a death that way. Yeah. But the other thing that appalled me was, quote unquote, pro-life people who, like, couldn't wait. Just wait 24 hours, will you? Just let his body cool, you know, before you begin, you know, shrieking about how we have to stand up to the president for, you know, and not allow him to appoint a successor and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, dudes, you're supposed to be pro-life, so show some respect for life and for the ending of life, and don't do this. He'll be just dead tomorrow. Don't worry. There's months and months where you can argue about this, but give it a day. And, you know, all of that was my response to it. And with that now, of course, now that the, you know, okay, it's been more than a day now. So now everybody's going berserk about the appointment process. But what's going with that has been this absolutely ridiculous, evidence-free, sudden tidal wave of speculation, of course, led by none other than Donald Trump.
Oh, did he?
Donald Trump just glommed onto this immediately. Well, I shouldn't say it was led by Donald Trump.
I'd like to, I can't think there's anything stupid he wouldn't glom onto. But
The guy has an infallible ability to just detect where the id monster will strike next and get there. So all of a sudden now, within just a few hours of Scalia's death, all the kooks way out on the fringe right are now speculating that Obama had Scalia murdered because
I had thought this was not a real thing. It was like a fringy thing, which it probably is. But then Scott Ault, I guess it was, I asked, you know, he was posting something on it. He was a Catholic writer for some various sites. And this is a real thing? And he said, yes, it's going on. I'm seeing
so,
it.
Oh, it's an absolutely real thing. And so, but okay, so there's that. Now, Trump is Trump, you know?
Trump got
this
Trump.
Way, you just know what he's going to do. I mean, it was like, it was easily foreseeable that Trump, who has this unerring sense for what the nutballs in the GOP are going to go for. And so now he's like, you know, stroking his chin and looking thoughtful and doing the thing that you always do when you want to say something, but you want to pretend that that's not what you're saying.
Right.
And so it's like, you know, well, some are saying that Obama, you know, that Scalia's death is suspicious. And, you know, I'm just asking questions.
I'm just asking questions.
I'm just asking questions. Right. And so it's like, yeah. And, you know, but so that's, you know, OK, Trump is going to be Trump. He's going to do that. But, you know, there are people, I will not say their name, but there is, in particular, there's a priest of Holy Church who is like urging this on his Facebook as something that we all need to think about and consider, like multiple times, you know, with Scalia murdered and this kind of thing. This is leads me into a discussion of scandal, and I want to talk about giving scandal when we come back. I think we're almost up against a break, because scandal is a very misunderstood idea in the church, and so when we talk about scandal, often what we mean by it, you know, in American parlance, well, we'll come back to it when we. Return from our break. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are here with Tom McDonald, who many do not think was responsible for killing Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. And we'll be back right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here with Mr. Tom McDonald. We are talking a little bit about scandal. Before I went to the break, scandal is a word that's deeply misunderstood. So scandal, in the churches, scandal does not mean what are Brad and Angelina doing today. And scandal also, by the way, you'll sometimes hear people say, so-and-so is giving, he said something that hurt my feelings.
Right.
And that's a scandal. That's not scandal.
No.
You know, my saying something, you're being upset, being upset on your part does not constitute giving scandal on my part.
Right. Scandal is scandolin from Greek, is stumbling.
Yeah. It means a stumbling block. So what scandal means is something that gets in the way, that tempts you to violate your conscience in obeying Jesus. That's what a scandal is. And so when we give scandal, what we're doing is we're urging somebody to do something that you and I and they all know are sinful or think is sinful. So there can be you can scandalize somebody by tempting them to do something that turns out to be objectively fine, right. Not sinful at all. So Paul writing to the Corinthians, for example, there's a struggle going on in Corinth and in other churches around the ancient world about what to do about eating meat. The problem with eating meat in the ancient world was the only place you could get your meat was typically meat that had been offered in sacrifice to a pagan god at one of the local shrines. So you sacrifice the cow and then you got all this meat. And so what do? Well, you sell it in order to help finance the shrine. So the local meat market guy comes and buys the meat and he sells it at market in the marketplace, and you take it home and you have your steak. Well, what troubled the conscience of Jews and of Jewish converts to Christianity was, if I eat this meat, am I participating in the sacrifice to the God that it was offered to? And Paul basically says, don't worry about it. He says, just give thanks to God for it. You're not participating in the pagan rite if you take the meat that you've received that God made, after all. Give thanks to God for it and then enjoy your dinner. And he says, so don't worry about that. But here's the thing, says Paul. There are people whose consciences are troubled, remain troubled by this. And so if I eat meat in front of them, they will feel tempted to eat in violation of their conscience. They think that they're insulting God by doing this.
Right.
And he says, so there's nothing wrong with eating meat, but I won't eat meat if it tempts somebody else to violate their conscience. And so all that is perfectly sensible.
Right.
But when we speak about giving scandal, then I would argue, for example, that a priest or any Catholic, really, who's running around on the basis of absolutely nothing, there's simply zero evidence for this at all, running around urging people to stroke their chins and spread the rumors slash theory slash conviction that in this case, the president of the United States is guilty of committing the murder of a Supreme Court justice.
But they're just asking questions.
That's scandal. Because what are you doing? Well, you're making an incredibly serious charge against somebody.
Sure.
On the basis of nothing. And it really,
I don't think this
has nothing to do, by the way, with, you know, who's in office, right? I don't care for Obama all that much myself. Didn't vote for him. But you don't go around saying he's guilty of murder or let's all talk about, you know, the theory that he's guilty of murder and between you and me, wink, wink.
Right. Right. There's always this wink thing, you know, it's almost like stirring people up, you know, it's something you may not even believe, but it's a useful hammer to use against a foe. So, you know, and that's what the political scene has become. And, you know, not that there was a pure period of American history. The political scene was, you know, was tainted by the time Jefferson got to it, you know, the early elections were pretty hideous, you know, so we've always resorted to dirty tricks, but now with electronic media, with social media and everything, we seem to be more disconnected from the real content of what we're sharing, what we're saying, what we're suggesting, and the real meaning of it in the real world. It seems to be these are just so many, you know, letters or pixels flickering across our screen. So, let's just share it. It's an interesting thing, and we'll get people stirred up a bit. And, you know, that's not less scandalous just because the medium has changed. A fair rule, if you're thinking about sharing something online or saying something, would you say it in the back of the church after Mass to either your priest or your fellow Christian?
Dagger through the heart.
Yeah.
I'm guilty of, you know, doing terrible things like that online too with speech.
Right. Well, and we should think,
you know, talking about person, people that I dislike and et cetera.
Is the person in front of me, you know, and we have to think we shouldn't be responding in a public forum necessarily any different than we would respond to, you know, I once got something from somebody who said, you'd never say that to my face. And because of the way I act online, I certainly would. And I'd say, tell me your address. Because I've been doing electronic media so long and I've been thinking about it so long because I was writing about it as a technology reporter you know, I've had to kind of consider it for a long time. And I think we've gotten it too fast that we aren't, we've adapted to it too quickly and too readily that we're not always, our ears are attuned to the tone and the meaning of what we're putting out there in this space, this electronic virtual space, and what it does on the other end, because it's read and perceived by tens, hundreds, thousands of others, depending on your reach. And if you spend, and I know you don't, but if you were to have spent any time on Twitter, which is far, far worse than Facebook, you'd get a better sense of how unhinged from real human relationships electronic media can be.
Yeah.
Because people will say the most outrageous, incredible things that they wouldn't even consider saying out loud. And if they consider saying them out loud, somebody should lock them up because it's terrible stuff.
There's the there's a form. It's been mastered by a web aggregator site called PewSitter. I call it the accusatory question mark.
Yes, it was.
It's you could say anything about anybody as long as you stick a question mark at the end.
Yeah, and it's usually someone like Simca Fisher or something. Simca Fisher, sinner? Question mark.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean that kind of passive aggression. But when what I wanted to say was that it's particularly scandalous if we happen to be in a position of power. To lead other people. The example that I use, for example, is the little kid whose parents have told him that Harry Potter is a dangerous occult book and he shouldn't read it. Now, I'm perfectly convinced in my own conscience that Harry Potter is just fine. I've enjoyed Harry Potter books. They're loads of fun. I enjoyed the movies, et cetera, et cetera. And to any adult who comes to me and asks me what I think, that's what I'll tell them. But if I go to a friend's house and they have this conviction that Harry Potter is a dangerous book and they're trying to raise their children, there is no way in the world I'm going to talk to their kid and take him aside and say, your parents are, don't ignore them right here. Have a Harry Potter book. Don't tell your parents,
They're all wet.
Yeah, that would be just a terrible thing to do. It would be giving scandal to this kid because it would be urging that kid to violate his own conscience at an age when he's not able to evaluate any of this for himself. And what I'm really doing to that kid is, I'm not liberating him so that he can, read a Harry Potter book. What I'm really doing is I'm poisoning the relationship between he and his parents.
Right.
And it's a deadly thing to do. And I would be grossly misusing my authority as an adult in that kid's life to do that to him. And so in the same way, if you're in a position of spiritual power, which people give to you whether you want it or not sometimes.
Right.
Something I've learned the hard way. I've had people write me, because I've said something atrocious to somebody or about somebody online because I was angry or whatever, and I've had people write me and say, I've read your work. Your work has meant a lot to me, and it really wounded me that you said this thing in anger. For me, that's been a shock multiple times because it's hard for me to believe that anybody cares what I think.
Right.
That sounds weird, but it's true. It's just, I'm not anybody. I mean, I'm not a bishop. I'm not a priest. I'm not some, I don't have a PhD. I don't have some title of authority. I'm just some guy with a keyboard. But those people care what I think, and I've given them scandal when I've done that. And so it's something that I've been thinking about for Lent. That's something I guess we can all think about, too. I want to thank you so much, Tom McDonald, for being on the show today. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And Ethan Bullen has been our producer, and I will be back tomorrow with Mr. Rod Bennett. Till then, bye-bye.
Bye. Good night, planet Earth.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.